Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 453, titled Vergès for the Defense. This is being recorded on March 28th of the year 2004. WFMU archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent shows are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older shows are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer address linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. Spitfire stocks all of the programs and lectures I've done over the years, and in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of this program available within a week or so of the airing of the broadcast. Now, Vergès for the Defense refers to Jacques Vergès, a person we've talked about in many different broadcasts. He is an extreme left-wing attorney from France. He's actually of mixed French and Vietnamese extraction, was a member of the Communist Party for many years, perhaps still is, but he also has formed a working relationship with a number of far-right elements, including one of the linchpins of post-World War II international fascism, François Genoux, a fellow, even though Genoux died in 1996, the institutions and relationships that he maintained continue to echo through our contemporary time. His name has cropped up, Genoux, that is, in several contexts in connection with September 11th. And also, Jacques Vergès is the law partner of Isabelle Coutant-Père, who is the French counsel for Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker. Note again that Genoux died in 1996, but with the relationship between Genoux, a key Nazi operative prior to, during, and after World War II, and with Jacques Vergès, a doctrinaire communist and alleged anti-colonialist, we're seeing one of the strangest manifestations of political strange bedfellows that one could possibly imagine in the post-war period, post-World War II period, and now in the post-Cold War period. That sort of a red-brown alliance, as alliances between the extreme right and extreme left are called in the former Soviet Union, is becoming more common. I brought up the name Jacques Vergès because he apparently is going to be playing a role as an advisor in the trial of Saddam Hussein, if Saddam Hussein ever does, in fact, come to trial. Article about that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday. That is Saturday, March 27th of the year 2004. This is an article by Colin Freeman, Dateline to Baghdad, headline, "The Barrister of Baghdad." In war crimes trial, a defense novice seeks help from Klaus Barbie's ex-lawyer in representing Hussein and his cronies. It reads in part, "One is an international legal legend nicknamed the Devil's Advocate. The other is a backstreet Iraqi lawyer who has never set foot in a criminal court in his life. Next week, however, they will meet to consider forming an unlikely partnership for one of the biggest legal circuses in modern history, the war crimes trials of Saddam Hussein and his cronies. Badi Izzat Izzat, a Baghdad lawyer who represents nearly half of the deck of 55 most wanted people from the Hussein era, will fly to Paris this weekend to confer with Jacques Vergès, the celebrated French defender of terrorist Carlos the Jackal and Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie. The pair, who will be meeting for the first time, will discuss possible legal strategies for what is likely to be a tough case even for Vergès, how to excuse more than three decades of state-sanctioned killings involving up to 1 million people. But while Vergès, who was serving as a consultant on the war crimes trial of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, will be on familiar territory, Izzat is on a nearly vertical learning curve. Operating out of cramped offices in a scruffy Baghdad side street, he is by trade a civil litigator who has never defended anyone on criminal charges. The sum total of his knowledge of international war crimes law, he admits, is what he has picked up from a human rights law textbook he bought only a few months ago. It is true, I have never done any kind of criminal defense work in the past, and under Saddam we had no such thing as war crimes law," unquote, said Izzat, again quoting, "But I hope that by linking up with Vergès and taking his advice and help, we can put together a proper legal defense," unquote. Skipping down about Vergès. Meanwhile, Vergès, a former commander in the French resistance, has indicated he may focus on the tacit involvement of Western powers, particularly the United States, in many of Hussein's acts of aggression. Quote, Western countries encouraged the war against Iran, he said in a recent interview. Quoting again, Western countries were present in Iraq through diplomatic delegations. They weren't blind. In the course of a trial, the fundamental element will be, you treat me like a pariah, but I was your friend. What we did together. I fired the bullet, but you're the one who gave me the gun. You even pointed out the enemy, unquote. If Azat does eventually represent Hussein, he plans to subpoena numerous world leaders and statesmen to ask them why they turned a blind eye to the former Iraqi leader's crimes for so long. This tribunal will embarrass Bush the father, and that will be bad for Bush the son, he told reporters. Saddam will talk, and the whole world will be able to listen, unquote. Before going to Paris, Azat was scheduled to stop in Amman, Jordan, where many of his clients' families live as fugitives after fleeing Iraq last April. I will be seeing at least 8 families, possibly including Saddam's daughters, he said. It's not clear yet whether they want me to represent them, but I will be able to pass any messages on to Vergès if need be. Hussein's family may well have reason to seek help elsewhere. Vergès is already 69, while Azat is 64. With Hussein's trial alone expected to take up to 5 years to complete, it is an open question whether the two will be fit for such a legal marathon. I would stress that it will be interesting to see if Saddam Hussein lasts that long. Who knows? For all we know, that could even be a double there. It might just very well be Saddam Hussein himself. But don't be surprised if Saddam Hussein doesn't last throughout that trial. It's already been reported in the tabloids that he's allegedly suffering from cancer. We'll see. Now, one of the interesting things about Jacques Vergès is, as I said, even though he is a lifelong doctrinaire communist and anti-colonialist, he also has had a working relationship with one of the kingpins of 20th century fascism and one of the most important figures in 20th century terrorism, François Genoux. And we're going to review a little bit of Genoux's background and then discuss his relationship with Jacques Vergès and some of their collaborative efforts. We're going to turn once again to a book we've used in the past for information about Genoux. That is Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, authored by Kevin Coogan, and published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. And as I've said in the past, my using of Kevin Coogan's material should not be misunderstood as constituting endorsement by Kevin for the working hypothesis I've been developing on September 11th. Of Genoux, Coogan writes, on May 30, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Genoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one wouldn't know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal? A Swiss citizen born in Lausanne in 1915, Genoux became rabidly pro-Nazi in the early 1930s. After a trip to Germany as a teenager, he never forgot the thrill he felt shaking Adolf Hitler's hand. During World War II, Genoux became extremely close to an SD lieutenant named Paul Diekopf, who would later head the German Federal Police, the Bundeskriminalamt, or BKA, before being elected president of the Interpol in 1968. By the way, SD is the SS Intelligence Service. Continuing about the relationship between Diekopf and Genoux. The two men traveled together across Europe. That's across occupied Europe. Diekopf would later claim that he had defected from the German army in August of 1942 and lived clandestinely in Belgium, where he embraced the anti-Nazi cause. Curiously, the traitor's salary continued to be sent to his wife until January of 1944. Diekopf eventually ended up in Switzerland, where he received support from Genoux. Diekopf went there to approach Alan Dulles, head of the local OSS, pretending to be an anti-Nazi. At the time, his boss, RSHA head Ernst Kaltenbrunner, was also sanctioning the Free Austria movement, unquote. He had another group of anti-Nazi Nazis intent on befriending Dulles. Diekopf quickly established a working relationship with one of the most mysterious American spies of World War II, the Japanese-born and Yale-educated Paul Blum, a top Dulles lieutenant who would later vouch for Diekopf's anti-Nazi credentials. Genoux, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Alan Dulles. Shortly after the war, Janu acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Another key player in the post-war Nazi underground resident in Switzerland was SD Colonel Eugen Dohlmann, General Wolff's chief lieutenant in the talks with Dulles. Besides Wolff, Dohlmann and Janu had another friend in common, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Janu first met the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem in 1930, and again in Berlin during the war. Dohlmann also maintained links to the Grand Mufti. After the July 23, 1952 Free Officers' Coup in Egypt, Janu established ties with an Egyptian intelligence operative named Major Fatih al-Dib. In post-coup Egypt, he experienced firsthand the strange mixture of left and right when half of Cairo's most influential weekly, Roz al-Yusef, was filled with references to figures like the Soviet writer Ilya Ehrenberg, and the other half carried reprints from anti-Semitic hate sheets like the American journal Common Sense. In 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote, Janu began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. By the way, parenthetically, the FLN, well, again, as indicated here, is the anti-French independence movement in Algeria. Continuing. Janu worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's SS network, including Janu's friend, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht. In Damascus, General Otto Reimer, Ernst Wilhelm Springer, and an ex-SS captain and RSHA operative named Alois Brunner created another gun-running operation, the Orient Trading Company, or OTRACO, to ship arms to the FLN militants. Janu's importance within the FLN increased when he became the group's banker. In 1952, Ahmed Ben Bella, one of the founders of the Algerian Organisation Speciale, or OS Independence Movement, escaped from a French jail. After spending several months underground, he resurfaced in Cairo to be personally blessed by Nasser. In the spring of 1954, Ben Bella left Cairo and traveled to Geneva, where he and three of his OS comrades created their organizational basis for the FN-FLN. In 1958, Janu and a Syrian named Zohir Mardam co-founded the Banque Commerciale Arabe in Geneva to manage the FLN's war chest. One of Janu's closest collaborators, Mohamed Kider, was Secretary General of the FLN's Political Bureau. Born in 1912, Kider had been the driving force behind the Egyptian section of Mouvement pour le Triomphe des Libertés Démocratiques, or MTLD, which helped launch the Algerian Armed Rebellion on November 1, 1954. After Algeria won its independence, Janu became head of the Banque Populaire Arabe in Algiers. In October of 1964, during a time of intense political infighting inside the FLN, Janu was arrested and charged with transferring $15 million of FLN money to his Swiss bank in Kider's name. He only escaped an Algerian jail thanks to the intervention of Egypt's President Nasser. The Algerian government then spent years fighting with Janu over the FLN treasury. Kider was assassinated in Madrid in 1967 by Algerian intelligence. Only in 1979 was the FLN war chest, unquote, finally returned to Algeria. Skipping down, but now we're going to see how Janu, whose heritage we've just examined, hooks up with the ultra-left French lawyer Jacques Vergès, who appears to be someone who's going to figure in at least an advisory capacity in the defense of Saddam Hussein. During the war in Algeria, Janu met with an ultra-left French lawyer named Jacques Vergès, who represented a number of FLN militants accused of terrorist bombings in Algiers' French section. Born in Thailand in 1925 to a French doctor and a Vietnamese woman, Vergès fought against the Nazis as a French Communist Party member in World War II. While a law student after the war, he continued his anti-colonialist agitation and became a good friend of Salot Sar, a young Cambodian student better known today as Pol Pot. Vergès then spent 1951 to 1954 in Prague, where he became the director of the World Communist Student Group, the International Union of Students. One of his colleagues, the Stalinist youth leader Alexander Shalepin, would become head of the KGB in the late 1950s. Vergès split with the French Communist Party because of its reluctance to support Algerian independence. He became a Maoist of sorts in the early 1960s, as well as a strong supporter of Cuba and the Tricontinental Congress because the Cubans stressed the need for worldwide anti-colonial revolts. After the 1967 war, Janu and Vergès would reunite to support the Arab struggle against Israel. On February 18, 1969, members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, attacked an El Al plane on the tarmac of Zurich's Kloten Airport. When the trial of three of the PFLP militants began in November 1969 in Winterthur, Switzerland, both Janu and Vergès were in the courtroom serving as advisors to the defendants. Janu's closest radical Arab friend was PFLP co-founder Dr. Wadi Haddad. A Greek Orthodox Christian, Haddad fled Palestine in 1948. He then studied medicine with his fellow Greek Orthodox colleague George Habash at the American University in Beirut. In the early 1950s, Haddad and Habash founded the Arab Nationalist Movement, or ANM, which published a small journal called Vengeance. Although their views were considered right-wing, they received encouragement from American diplomats for their opposition to the continued British and French colonial domination of the region. In 1955, when Egypt turned to the East Bloc, the ANM followed. By 1958, the group, which by now had established small branches in Egypt, Kuwait, Yemen, Syria, and other Arab nations, was calling itself socialist and demanding a united Arab response against Israel. The ANM's embrace of socialism eventually led to an internal factional struggle in which Haddad and Habash represented the right, while Nayef Hawatmeh stood for the more ideologically orthodox left. After the 1967 war, the ANM was reorganized and became the PFLP. Now, the group, by the way, that's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Now, the group praised Mao, Lin Piao, Che Guevara, and the Tricontinental Congress. Habash and Haddad declared themselves leftists and embraced the Vietnamese Revolution because of U.S. support for Israel. Hawatmeh's more orthodox Marxist faction, however, believed their left turn, unquote, was inspired less by ideology than by opportunism, and split with the PFLP to become the Popular Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PDFLP. Wadi Haddad, who was more a man of action than a theorist like Habash, took command of the PFLP's overseas operations. He soon attracted support from a variety of allies, including the Japanese Red Army faction, the Baader-Meinhof Group Red Army faction, the Irish National Liberation Army, an IRA splinter group, and individual volunteers like Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. Another PFLP volunteer was a young Swiss man named Bruno Breguet. On June 23, 1970, Breguet was arrested in Haifa, Israel, while on a PFLP bombing mission. After his arrest, Janu organized a campaign for his release from prison. Although he had been sentenced to 15 years, Breguet was allowed to leave Israel in 1977. By the early 1980s, he was an important member of the Carlos Network in Europe. As for Haddad, he adored the Swiss banker and dubbed him Chic François, unquote. After Haddad's death from cancer in the East Berlin Hospital on March 27, 1978, Janu continued to maintain close ties with his terrorist network. Janu also worked with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, in particular, its Black September terrorist network headed by Ali Hassan Salameh, the Red Prince, who was assassinated by the Israeli Secret Service on November 22, 1979. One of Janu's intermediaries to the PLO was Fuad el-Shamali, a former student leader with the Syrian National Social Party that had been destroyed after a failed coup attempt in Lebanon. Janu also developed excellent ties to Libya through his Egyptian friend Fatih el-Dib, who introduced him to Abdel Mouman el-Honi, the director of the Libyan Secret Service. He handled Libyan contributions to the PLO, and helped mediate relations between the Libyans and the IRA through Jean-Yann Lhostellier, a Breton nationalist and former Waffen-SS volunteer. On September 5, 1972, Black September terrorists murdered 11 Israeli athletes at the Olympic Games in Munich. The head of Interpol at the time of the attack was Janu's old friend, former SS man Paul Diekhoff. Janu had lobbied the secret services of the Middle East to support Diekhoff's bid to become Interpol president. Diekhoff's Interpol proved highly reluctant to get itself involved in stopping any form of terrorism. As one Interpol spokesman argued, the Arab-Israeli conflict was a political question, and Interpol was an agency designed to handle criminal, not political matters. The early 1970s saw a series of terrorist attacks throughout Europe. Janu's friend Jacques Vergès, however, was not involved in giving legal assistance to captured militants. One day in February of 1970, he disappeared from Paris after announcing that he was going on a business trip to Spain. Then, just as mysteriously, he showed up on the streets of Paris 8 years later in the winter of 1978. Asked where he had been, he explained, quote, "I stepped through the looking glass where I served an apprenticeship," unquote. In the early 1980s, Janu and Vergès returned to center stage. On February 16, 1982, Janu's friend Bruno Breguet and a German woman named Magdalena Kopp were arrested in Paris after police discovered guns, hand grenades, and 4 kilos of explosives in their car. Kopp, it turned out, was a member of the German revolutionary cells created by Johannes Weinrich. She was also Carlos's common-law wife. Vergès took charge of their legal defense while Janu paid the bills. Meanwhile, Carlos began writing threatening letters to French Interior Minister Gaston Defferre while a series of bombs went off in different parts of the country. The Kopp-Breguet trial proved to be a warm-up for another, even more spectacular Janu and Vergès operation, the legal defense of Klaus Barbie, a Nazi war criminal who had been extradited from Bolivia to France in 1982. While engaged in his Arab adventures, Janu continued to maintain excellent relations with top Nazis like General de Grelle, General Wolf, and General Reimer. He was also close to New European Order founder Guy Amadruz, who ran the NEO's main branch out of Lausanne, which happened to be Janu's hometown. Parenthetically, by the way, the New European Order is a European fascist group. Continuing. Asked his opinion of Amadruz, Janu said that his, quote, "grande vertu, il est extrêmement fidèle, courageux, c'est un sang." In English, his great virtue is that he is extremely loyal and courageous. He's a saint, unquote. Janu and Vergès used Barbie's trial to condemn France for its crimes against Algeria. Although Barbie was easily convicted, many questions about him remained. During his time in Bolivia, Barbie regularly fed the CIA information on the left throughout Latin America using a contact in Bolivia's Interior Ministry. Yet Barbie and Hans Ulrich Rudel, his partner in the weapons business, were believed to have had Cuban ties. Barbie was also reportedly involved in supplying weapons to the Italian ultra-leftist millionaire Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli. It remains an open question whether Janu helped Barbie simply out of abstract principle or because he himself had been a player in Barbie's arms and intelligence operation. By the way, speaking of Barbie, which we've done in many broadcasts in the past, in RFA program number 27, we took a look at the Moon Organization's involvement in the so-called cocaine coup of 1980, in which Klaus Barbie and his bridegrooms of death, Coca Fascisti mercenaries, basically came to power and for a time presided over the Bolivian cocaine trade and also provided much of the parapolitical and paramilitary muscle for the fascist regime that was in power at that time. Again, we're reviewing this material, and we've covered Janu and Vergès in other broadcasts, because Vergès now appears to be someone who is going to be participating, at least in an advisory capacity, in the legal defense of Saddam Hussein, should that defense actually come to fruition. There are a number of things to note in this context. First of all, note that the very mysterious disappearance of Jacques Vergès from February of 1970 to the winter of 1978. He vanished, and he says, "I stepped through the looking glass where I served an apprenticeship," unquote. That's an enigmatic statement, but of course, bear in mind now that Janu was a doctrinaire communist, originally a French communist, a member of the French Communist Party. He split with them and became a Maoist, but his political sympathies were extreme left. Of course, in a mirror, right and left are reversed. One of the possibilities here is that perhaps he formed something of an alliance, or at least developed a greater affinity for far-right and or fascist elements. Again, Spain under Franco in this time was a hotbed of Nazi emigre activity, and his eight-year disappearance is very mysterious. And again, one wonders about the reference to stepping through the looking glass where I served an apprenticeship. I would note that one of the things that Janu and Vergès, as well as some of the other extreme left-wing associates of Janu and extreme right-wing associates have in common is not only anti-Semitism, but anti-Americanism as well. As we've noted in a number of broadcasts, the background milieu of François Janu has a lot in common with the background milieu of the Bank al-Taqwa. Janu and Bank al-Taqwa director Ahmed Huber were very close. Janu was also close to Saeed Ramadan, the linchpin of the Muslim Brotherhood for a period of time. François Janu's friend and attorney, Baudin Dunant, is also the co-chairman of the board of directors of SICO, the Saudi investment company, that is the parent holding company in Europe for the bin Laden business enterprises. And as we've dealt with in other broadcasts, Ernest Bacchus, the Luxembourg-based European expert on money laundering, has stated in interviews both with the Financial Journal Plus Minus and also with Bavarian State Radio that he felt when the money trail for the September 11th attacks was traced back to its origin, it would go back to organizations that were founded by François Janu and were apparently still in operation. In the Bavarian State Radio interview, Ernest Bacchus also opined that François Janu had served as a banking and investment advisor to the bin Laden family. So again, even though dead since 1976, Janu's name and his influence is very much felt today. And note again that milieu is very much with us today. And Youssef Nada, former German intelligence agent, head of Bank al-Taqwa, defendant in the trillion-dollar lawsuit that has been filed by survivors of the victims of September 11th, Youssef Nada, according to an article in the Asia Times that we looked at in FTR 416, actually helped Janu's good friend, the Grand Mufti, escape from Germany at the end of World War II. So, again, the past is never dead. It isn't even really past a point. Note again, Jacques Vergès, protege of François Janu, and his apparent legal advisory role in the upcoming trial of Saddam Hussein. Note again that Vergès's law partner, Isabelle Coutant-Père, the wife-to-be of Carlos the Jackal, is the French attorney for Zaharias Moussaoui, the accused 20th hijacker. WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked to both that address and the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. There'll be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program 453 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. Listeners who would like to support the work that I'm doing will find a button on which to click at the beginning of each For the Record description. Spitfire website now equipped with a search engine and also featuring the landmark text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning for download for free on Adobe Acrobat. This concludes For the Record program number 453, Vergès for the Defense, being recorded on March 28th of the year 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.